just
very brief.
Well, I sent it to Lisa and said, make it short, whether or not she wanted to.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the second part of the regional network meeting. Just before I introduce Jim and we move into the next turn, Mark's agreed, if we finish at 3 o'clock, which we're planning to, Mark's agreed to show people some of the artwork that he talked about. It'd be helpful if people could just indicate if they wanted to go on that little walk with him. Do you want to just say what you might be able to do, Mark? So if people want to do that, Mark, you'll at 3 o'clock or just after, you'll take them with you there. Okay, well, we'll congregate in here. Well, thank you for that. It's good to see some of the work on such a pleasant... our next speaker has already been mentioned, Jim Buckley. He's working on the Knightstone project with Mark. Jim has a very varied background, higher education. He founded and became Director of Ideas in Public Space Limited in 2005. And he's worked on many public art installations in Strathclyde, in Glasgow, in Ireland, and internationally around the world. And he's also received a number of awards, ranging from the Saltire Society Award to the Scottish Arts Council's Creative Scotland Award. Jim's current projects, in addition to working in places like Wigan, is the Knightstone project, which Mark alluded to this morning. So Jim's going to talk more about that project now, and then we'll have a chance to ask him some specific questions on that before we bring the panel back. So thank you very much, Jim, for coming down.
Okay, I'm going to quickly run through some earlier projects that I've done going back using like sort of 14, 15 years ago, because I think there is a perception that it's something that's new and is only happening in the last 6 or 8 or 10 years, and I think it is something that artists have been using for quite a long time in different ways. My title here, Ideas in Public Space, is sort of a concept I've been working with for quite a long time, and that sort of became formal in 2005 when I formed a company with another artist, Jim Hamlin, and an architect, Scottish naval architect, Ivan Dunn. At the moment, it's based in Savannah, so we carry out quite an interesting way of communicating, which is mostly on Skype, in terms of how we put projects together and how we manage them. So that's kind of interesting as well, in terms of how collaborations work, and we physically have to be even in the same site for to make things happen. I think that's probably something that could be touched on some other time. Going back to 1993, which is 14 years ago, this is sort of, in a way, the first large-scale light work that I did. Many of the works, I guess, have regeneration as a sort of common theme in them, in that quite often the work is temporary, so it's used more as a vehicle to draw attention to a site or to reinterpret the site so that it can be developed or reused in some way. This is a former fish farm. It's a very idyllic situation. It's got a river running past, a waterfall in the background. It's surrounded by woodlands. And yet it's in very close proximity to two villages in the mountains in the foot of the Japanese Alps. I was in Japan as part of a sort of a symposium, and one of the things we were looking at was the degradation of the rivers in Japan, partly because floodplains were being taken away and the effect that was having on fish population, on the ability for fish to come upstream to spawn, etc. And the artists working on the symposium were asked if they would like to make a piece of work, and many people made smaller pieces or you know, did a series of photographs or something like that. The piece was sort of conceived and up and running in 2 weeks, so it was done very, very quickly. And it was dependent on collaboration from all sorts of people, from suppliers of equipment and materials to local government to a whole range of people. When I I basically kind of went walkabout for a couple of days, found the site, and then came back and said, this is what I want to work with. The local organizers weren't even aware of the site, that it existed, so it was kind of something that had been hidden and forgotten, and nobody was paying any particular attention to it. Briefly, cleared out some of the fish tanks, which are kind of like small swimming pools, really, in terms of scale, and reactivated the water system, and then installed a very simple light work, which you can see here at dusk, where it's just beginning to sort of appear in the valley, and you can see the landscape that surrounds it. And then this is sort of what the piece looked at like at night. And curiously for me, when you sort of see it from this angle, which is where Body viewed it from, which was a bridge that sort of spanned the valley, these tanks kind of take on the look of fish as well. So there's kind of a very direct sort of translation. And the reason I chose fish is obviously because of how fish pervades Japanese society. I mean, it's crucial food for the Japanese. And even if you're on a mile inland, fish is still on the menu. It isn't just if you're by the sea. The piece was conceived to be temporary, initially run off generators. It then got connected up to the highway lighting system, so it came on every evening at dusk and went off at dawn. And then about a year and a half later, the site was purchased. It's now a fish farm again, so the network doesn't exist anymore. So it kind of, to my mind, sort of served a regeneration purpose, and it's just a memory now, I guess. Moving forward to a piece I did in Dundee in 2002. This is a new dance school, and the brief here was it was more a signage brief or a navigation brief, and the idea was to sort of draw attention to the site, particularly let people know what performances were taking place, because as well as being a school, it's also a theatre and performance space, and it was a way of sort of navigating people through the complex of buildings that surround this to the actual performance space at night. So the light work, which is this fibre optic piece in the trees, or in the tree, which was really the only tree that was saved from the construction work, is only on if there's a performance on at the site. So it's something that's on all the time. The work functions, I guess, as a marker. It's been renamed locally as the Three Giraffes, which is really nice. And these are just sort of some of the details of the piece. An earlier work, which also involved light, and this time projection, is a piece from Cork in Ireland. It's an old mill that's due for demolition. In fact, it's still standing. So in 2002, it was due for demolition. It has survived much longer. And it's really the last remaining evidence of the usage of the docks in Cork, which are pretty well in the centre of town, because everything has moved way further right now because of health and safety and various other issues like that. But the demise of the docks brings with it the demise of a whole community who are dependent on that. So divers and stevedores and crane drivers and truckers and all of these people sort of lose out as well. So this piece was done not to solve the problems, but really to draw attention to it. And strategically, the piece ran during the Cork Film Festival and the Cork Jazz Festival. So it was geared for a time when you had most press and most sort of activity in the city. And it managed to get sort of national television coverage as part of those festivals. The scale of the work, it's about 100 feet high and about 45 feet wide. So it's 3 meters of those, and you're working in meters. It's the building, being an industrial building, and the Cork predominantly being sort of a city of 2-3 story buildings, towers above everything else. So it's seen from various vantage points around the city. And this is looking across the river to the site. This is looking from the west towards the site. And this is sort of up quite close. The piece, which is basically a still image of a waterfall, is remembered as a moving image. And that's, I guess, for a number of reasons. One is that the waterfall is pretty well the same size as the actual building, so I was very careful to photograph a waterfall that would look as realistic as possible. And so I'm moving through these quite quickly, and anyone can talk to me about them later, but it's kind of to put in context where I am now and sort of the work that I'm doing. This is a piece I did for the Gwangju Biennale in Korea in 2004. The site is a brand new subway station, so it's pristine, clean, and in a way, it doesn't have a history, which is kind of something that I don't normally work with, because I tend to work with buildings or sites that do have a history or have something in a way to sort of refer to or integrate to the work. But the site was, in a way, so clean and so pristine that it felt clinical, and what I wanted to do was, in a way, to kind of humanize it and to sort of animate that. And choosing the title Chameleon, it's to do with the idea that as people move through the site, or through the subway station, they effectively change, right? Because the lighting is laid out in a series of blocks that people pass through. And their clothing and their body basically picks up the colour, and they become an integral part of the artwork. I suppose an interesting aspect here, I'll be talking more about, you know, the carbon footprint that light work brings, or maybe doesn't bring with it. For this artwork, I didn't actually install any lights. All I did was put filters in the existing lighting. And the organizers were so enamored with the idea, I suppose, and so pleased with it, that I was also asked to do a train. This is an actual functioning train, which was also used as part of the Biennale for, you know, there were other artists exhibiting it as well, but it did bring up, obviously, issues on health and safety. So, for example, all the doorways, lighting block is always yellow because that gets the highest lumens, but the rest of it could be the color I wanted to use. And this is a series of temporary pieces that I did in Aberdeen in 2005 in the middle of summer, which, as you can imagine, Aberdeen doesn't give you much darkness to work with anyway. So you're kind of working from 10:30, 11 o'clock at night to about 3 in the morning. After that, it's bright again. So. But that's when they wanted an artwork, and so that's when they got one. The piece looks at five buildings of various architectural merit, but they're all due for some kind of regeneration or rebuilding or possible demolition at the present time. And so the actual... my equipment and everything was on a truck and computer-controlled lights. And what we did was we went unannounced to one of the sites each night, set up. People never knew exactly where the work was going to be, so they would just kind of come across it when they're coming out of the clubs or the pubs or whatever. They just come across the work. You can actually see there's a truck with a white generator on it. There's a white truck at the bottom of that building, which is actually where everything is controlled from. I won't go into what the buildings are because, you know, there's a whole talk on why the buildings were chosen and sort of exactly what the outcome was as well with each of them, but it's just to sort of put it in context. And that brings us to, in 2005, along with another artist, Jim Hamlin, and Ivan Drummond, as I mentioned earlier, who's a naval architect, we formed Ideas in Public Space Limited as a company. And in a way, kind of coincidentally, our first major commission was for Knightstone Island. We do have other jobs on, so it's not as if it's the only one. We set up as well a series of, I guess, kind of a manifesto, but in a way, what our vision was. And our vision was to integrate work into the existing context, to make work which reflects the importance of the site, to work simply with the intrinsic qualities of a site, to create work which has a time-based element in it so that it reveals itself over a period of time, so that it isn't sort of an instant splash, that it's much more something that is for either local residents or for multiple visits, or you know, has some time element in it. To see the work as something that's a dynamic event, but which is always subtly changing or subtly different. To create work which serves functional as well as aesthetic ends. And I think that's really important, and I think that's an area where it allows the artist to actually go past the aesthetic issues that they're being asked to deal with, or just producing an artwork as such, but where you can actually produce an artwork that also serves a function, or as I mentioned in the case of Nightstone, where the artwork actually reduced the amount of lighting that's needed on the set rather than adding to it. To neutralise the carbon footprint as far as possible, to incorporate technical innovation. I mean, some of these are very obvious things, and probably just in the audience will probably be using these anyway. To create work which is enduring, to create work which is low maintenance or maintenance free, and to use funds creatively to maximise output. So it's almost kind of like, I don't know, in engineering terms, it's kind of value engineering something and actually find ways of using the artwork to do more than it's initially set up to do, and to create work which challenges, which is challenging, but is also accessible on a number of levels to a wider audience as possible. Now, because of those technical issues, the torus on the right-hand side there should actually spin, and I'll explain what that is in a minute. When we visited Nightstone, we had about an hour before our interview to sort of look at the site. We'd been sent a brief and sent various bits of information and historical images and photographs, etc. The brief didn't specifically ask for lighting as part of the solution. I think the brief, in a way, probably talked more about recognising the historical importance of the island, and also it had a navigational element in that Mark probably didn't kind of fully explain earlier, but most of the island is really private, and there's only a circular walkway that goes around, which is about 400 metres, Mark, something like that, which is public access. So in a way, that was our site. That walkway around the island is really the only space you had to work with. You could, of course, mount something on the buildings or do other things like that. And in our initial walk around the island, which at that stage was very much a building site, we noticed that there were these existing holes in the wall, which were basically scuppers for taking water off the island when waves come over the sea wall. And there are 54 of these, and we decided that we would make those our focus for an artwork, which involves light, but also involves a cast aluminium element. And just these images here just sort of show the different, what the island would kind of look like in terms of the way these lights would change over a period of time. Now, the torus up on the right-hand side is basically an illustration of how the colours will change on the island in relation to the movement of the tides. So the working goes through a lunar cycle, which was mentioned earlier, so it responds to the moon, but ultimately the effect that has on the tides. And so if you're somebody who lives locally, you'll know that at high tide, the light is always going to be white, and at low tide, it's always going to be blue. And in between, you'll be able to tell whether it's an incoming tide or an outgoing tide. And this is really just a mapping of how that would be kind of programmed to reflect the movement of the tide. Into the seawall, we're putting these cast elements, which are cast aluminium, and they basically take the place of the existing wall that was in the wall, because a lot of these are being destroyed anyway and rebuilt. And in those, we put our colour change light as changes in relation to the tides. Now, an interesting, a number of interesting aspects. One was that in order for our artwork to work, we needed low light levels. And the only way to achieve low light levels for us as artists to take over the amenity light as well. So we said we would take that on. It's not quite as simple as that. It obviously took a lot of input from Mark and a lot of support from Mark to make that possible. But through a series of discussions and questioning really what the light levels were or what light levels were required, we've got to a stage now where we've actually dispensed with most of the amenity lighting, and that allows our work to actually function much better and effectively generating more than is required for people to walk around the island. The light boxes protrude through the wall anywhere that that we can do that. In some places where is it the Waverley that comes in? We can't do that because obviously they will get damaged. So these are like kind of gargoyles in a way, kind of contemporary gargoyles that are cut at different angles or in different shapes, which are seen both from the channel and also from the promenade here. But the idea is that as much as possible the light is contained within the boxes rather than something that kind of spills out. It does spill onto the footpath if you're walking around the island. And these grooves here are kind of a reference to the waves as well. The reason these are like this is I just got the images of these just before I came here, because this is the first sample that's been cast, so we're still sort of working on the final finishing of this, but these are setting to the wall. So if you can imagine, these boxes are all cast at, I think it's about 900 at the moment. And then depending on the width of the wall, some places they'll just be 600 or 650, whatever the width of the wall is. In some places they'll extend out for another 200 or 250. So that's kind of basically what the light work is. The LEDs are powered by two wind generators, because part of the brief that we were asked to respond to was to create a gateway feature for the island. And instead of kind of coming up with some sort of a sculptural element which didn't have a function, we're basically building two pillars which have windmills on them that form the gateway of the island, but they also supply more energy than is required to run the light work. And then there are other elements such as flag, which will have the torus on it, so that it's kind of in a way an educational element that people can actually begin to understand what's going on with the lights. And then there are various other elements which are sort of cut into stone in the performance area and at a number of other points around the island, which are all information to relate to waves in different ways. It could be an anecdotal story that could relate to, or it could be it's a wave theory that an engineer or a scientist could actually understand and relate to, so that the work in a way could be used educationally, but it can also sort of, it has something there to grab people from different backgrounds with different information in their heads or different knowledge or different education. So it's kind of intended to engage anyone that would have any interest in a way in waves or in the sea or all of that. Mark, I might need your help now if we're going to technical
Sorry, I'm not a PC person and I've ended up using one.
How do we get on to the second piece that we're doing, which this should be looped, but it's not.
which is for the ladies' baths, which is one of the buildings on the site. And this is a section 106, is that correct? Mm. So as part of what we're doing on the island, we're also doing the sort of responsibility of the developer, or helping them to fulfil their responsibility. And this is effectively a semi-private work, and it's more for the residents or visitors to the apartments, or to the sort of private section of the site. And the work is going to be two projectors which project what looks like sunlight reflecting off water and then reflecting back onto the walls of the building, with a soundtrack that's recorded in a local swimming pool over a 24-hour period, so that at night it's totally quiet unless the building's broken into or something. kind of has most activity during the day. And it's pretty sort of low level, and it's kind of in the background, but every now and again if somebody dives in or makes a splash or whatever, there'll be sort of a splash. The work is... This is just a simulation of what it's going to be like, and it's only yesterday, really, that we kind of got to see really what the site's going to be like. So it'll be projected quite high up in the space, which is sort of the main entrance for the users of the apartments. But also at night, it will appear through a couple of windows as well. So if you're coming in to walk around Knightstone Island itself, you will actually see little bits of this appear in windows which are in the public space as well. I think that's kind of where we're at the moment. All of this is due to be completed in the next couple of months probably. But it's almost a 2-year period at the moment, and it's just part of what's involved in projects like this. You have to be in as early as possible, and then you have to stick with it for 2-3 years. Kind of run through that, but I think people want to sort of ask questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim, for that. Mark, did you have anything to add about Knightstone in terms of what Jim has said, or have you covered it all?
I think one of the points that came out, it's been a very difficult project and a changing project, because we're dealing with a lot of outside issues, environment agency. The buildings are actually built as a flood protection into the buildings on Knightstone. It needs to be as strong as a harbour wall in terms of, so all those like wave sort of frames in them and things like that. So it's quite a challenging scheme, and I certainly think actually today that if the developers had known what they were going to have to do, they probably wouldn't have touched the barge pole, to be honest, actually, because no one's making any money. But I think actually the impact of it will be for the rest of the town, it won't be for the site itself. And it actually gives that confidence. And one of the things about the latest bath work that Jim perhaps didn't mention was, I think that we went around a few options in order to get this effect. And I think what Jim and his team have come up with is actually quite remarkable in a way, in terms of, if I'm wrong, Jim, jump in.
It's all right.
Okay. Actually sort of creating these effects, I think, because Jim Hammond had worked in a gallery and he'd done things like this actually through projecting light through water to create this sort of effect in what was a former swimming pool as it is here. Of course, that actually threw up all sorts of issues about how you actually did that. And then Jim's team actually came across a computer program which would project an image of a pool on the floor. And this was high technology, and I think that I certainly wanted to go back to something which actually felt like it was an installation almost. And I think that you tested glass, didn't you? Different pieces of glass going around. So although that image looks like water, it's actually just sort of actually two discs,
two glasses
interacting with each other to create that effect. And I think that's just a just an amazing outturn, actually. It's a very low tech in some ways, but it creates what is, would have a longevity as a permanent work. So, hats off, really.
I suppose, as well, I mean, the question that I'm supposed to be answering is what do artists bring to these sorts of situations? And also, I think it's important, well, for me as an artist, I don't particularly want to be known as a light artist. I want to be known just as an artist, and that you bring whatever solutions right to the site or to the situation. And that mostly does involve sunlight, but it involves other elements as well. So they can be sculptural, they can be sound, or they can be interactive, or different things like that. But I suppose in terms of projects, which quite often, as I mentioned earlier, to do with regeneration, I guess what this brings is meaning to forgotten elements, which I think is one thing that probably the architects and the engineers and other people who are closely involved have different agendas, and they don't have the time or the kind of freedom to explore a lot of that. They kind of have a budget and a time scale that they have to operate to, whereas the artist is able to come in and kind of stand back and look at everything that's going on and pick up things that nobody else is noticing. So, for example, in Knightstone, we picked up on the scuppers, which to everyone else were just holes in the wall. Actually, they're really important functionally, and if you can kind of add to that, then that's really important. Something I didn't mention as well as we were going through that, another lighting element that was due to be added to the site was a flood warning system, which would involve light. And so what we've done is we're adding extra controls and extra programming into what we do with the night lights, so that they become the actual flood warning system. So there's basically an override. So if there's a flood warning, the artwork ceases and it becomes flood warning lights. And again, they're visible all the way around the island. And they don't take up any extra space. They don't take up any extra equipment. They don't take up any extra power or anything like that. So I think it's important, for us as an artistic team, that we can kind of come in and in a way reduce what's going on, and kind of reduce the light levels and reduce duplication that goes on a lot of the time as well. And that's partly because a lot of people have their jobs to do and they're not talking, you know, there isn't a general discussion with everybody. And that's where somebody like Mark has been, you know, absolutely crucial to all of this happening, because if Mark wasn't there, we wouldn't have been able to get those discussions happening, or we wouldn't be able to kind of bring everybody together. Okay, maybe we're kind of coming up with the artwork, but without Mark, it just wouldn't have been possible, I think. And I think that's, you know, it's really important that the right people are in planning or in urban design or in situations where the influence really needs to be kind of made, because artists can't really get into that sort of situation unless there's a way in for them.
Okay, are there any specific questions for Jim coming out of his presentation? Even for a chocolate? No? Okay, I'm going to ask the other two to join us again now, Mark and Oliver. Yeah, sure. Do you want to take them? I suppose we've been together again, what was the reaction to the others involved, not Mark, but to the engineers and so on, about you adapting the flood warning system to the flood warning system?
Well, I think the flood warning system was the least contentious. Right. It was much more contentious about the actual amenity lighting, because it was, you know, health and safety says we have to have certain light level, and you know, you have to have that. And I think it was really Mark's persistence and kind of pushing, well, what really is required and what's the designation and all of that. And I think sometimes just sort of changing the designation of something. Mark, you know more about the details of this, but that's kind of what's happened, isn't it? That it's kind of been the designation.
Yeah, I think there's always a lot of assumptions when it comes to the public realm of what standards you ought to be using. I think no one questions those sort of standards. And if you get people in a room and you actually say, well, do we need to light it at all? Then people start asking that question of themselves. And the answer came out, well, why do we need to light it? Light it because the wall is an obstacle and you might fall over the edge of it into the sea. But actually there's lights in the walls, and so you're not going to sort of fall over the wall. So, and because it's not a highway, it actually doesn't have any standards, but people apply highway standards to these sorts of spaces. But if you walk through an urban park, you know, you don't have lots of light in there. And it was just actually trying to put, sometimes I think it's good to ask the question that you think there must be a simple answer to this, but if you could just keep asking those questions to people, you know, sometimes you appear to be pretty stupid when they turn around and say, well, surely you know that. But it's always good to ask those questions, because sometimes the answers that come back are the ones that you want.
Okay. One of the things that Jim talked about was the important role of the kind of broker, which is what you provided between various different groups of people and so on. In terms of developing projects like this, what kind of skills do you think the different people need to actually make them happen?
I think with people skills, really, I think you need to just actually, whatever skills you bring to the table, I think it's important that you interact with other people, and actually that you trust them, what they're bringing to the table too. And I think that getting on with people is the most important skill with this sort of work, because invariably people tend to put little fences around themselves and in camp and set up camps, and it's sort of breaking those sorts of things down. I mean, you talked about honesty before, and I think just being completely honest all the time is a good lesson sometimes.
But there are stories, aren't there, about clashes between lighting engineers and artists and so on. These come up time after time again. I mean, how damaging have some of those been, do you think, in projects you've worked on? And Oliver, maybe you can, in terms of your knowledge of activity.
Yeah, I was going to ask a general question that maybe people from the audience can join in as well, about the general receptiveness of developers to schemes like this, you know, and whether there was any resistance from the developer point of view. I haven't personally identified much kind of that much distance between artists and engineers as such. You know, maybe if other people have, you know, seen a schism, then you know, I'd be interested to hear it. But it seems that, you know, the sort of provided the balancing is right, I haven't seen much many problems. I mean, was there any?
I think there's an awful lot of commonality actually between artists and actually people in the development industry, because I think that there is, in your training as an architect and engineer, there's this whole thing about what things look like and the aesthetics of them. I think it's just one of those things that people get used to not trying to reinforce. You know, I say quite a lot, but architects often surround themselves with engineers to make sure the building stands up, but they don't support their aesthetic side. And I think that actually, I mean, when I've worked in multidisciplinary teams, it's amazing how people have actually do take on roles. I remember I worked on one project where we had an artist, an engineer, an architect, an urban designer, and I think if anyone had walked into the meetings, you wouldn't have been able to actually tell who was who. And in fact, the artist in that instance was extremely knowledgeable about the properties of various metals, and I'm sure if anyone had walked in, I would have thought it was the engineer, and the engineer was one of these chaps that went on holiday and loved to see all these things around the world and had the photos and the ideas back. And you break down those sort of barriers, and the artist brings out the creativity in the people he works with as well.
So. Yeah. On the other hand, you did do this interesting exercise before lunch of inviting us to sort of check who we thought each particular of the schemes was, as it were, led by. Was it an artist? It seemed that people sort of got that right, by and large. So, you know, there must be some sort of difference. Maybe it's a difference of starting point.
I think there's a difference if the artist is in the team. I think that's what a lot of those examples sort of showed, because I think you do get the more, the sort of deeper work, if you like, actually, that has more meaning to it. And I think that's what people were recognising, that some of those schemes didn't have the meaning, and they recognised, therefore, that perhaps there wasn't an artist on the team. And I think that was the difference between those particular schemes, where the artist was there and where the artist wasn't there.
Yeah, and I mean, is there a point at which developers are leading the agenda at all? Are you seeing a situation where developers say, we want this?
I think it's not very necessarily easy to persuade a developer to most developers that seem to want actually high quality schemes and all the rest of it, I think that I don't think they're always a block to these things. I think sometimes they feel these things are foisted upon them and they can't necessarily see why they haven't got. I think it's like anything. If you ask people to do something and you ask them to do it the way they want to do it, then you get somewhere. If you ask people to do something and then you tell them how you want to do it, then often you don't get anywhere, and I think that can be one of the issues.
Mm. Are there any examples from projects people have worked on in the audience where problems have come up or you've encountered particularly helpful developers in terms of the projects you've done?
Oh, it's promising, isn't it?
I don't want to reveal my secrets, I think.
Scoring well here.
Problems, really. Yes, please, at the back there.
I'm Pascoe from Redruth, Economics Art Partnership. We're starting a lighting scheme in the town. We've had the initial lighting plan or scheme done to 10 o'clock, which Peter Freeman has done for us, and that's the sort of initial start. And we're hoping to light architectural features in the town, and we're looking at it in all broad aspects. But one of the problems I think we're coming up against rapidly now is the time scale of talking to various people. And obviously, if you've got a building in a conservation area, then you have got to do a planning consent form, which takes 8 weeks, and you find that a grant offer should have been in, or a grant application should have been in by, say, the 23rd, and this is going to take another 8 weeks, and it's like trying to get everything coordinated, and it seems to be difficult to get everybody around the table at the same time talking about the same thing. And you know, going forward that way, I think it's going to be a nightmare, to be honest. But I don't know if there are tips of how to plan. I mean, we're not talking about new builds now at the moment. We're talking about a town with a lot of architectural features and open space and trees. And I think it needs a lot of coordination for so many different people to make it a success.
No, all I was going to say was that's a really interesting thing. I mean, you seem to have it pretty together here, I would say, Mark. I mean, maybe that's your question. I mean, presumably it needs a project manager. Type individual.
Yeah, someone to take that role, yeah, someone to take the management role. I think that, I mean, that throws up a question about, I was talking to a project manager who was talking about the Millennium sort of stadium, and he said actually that they did because they broke all the rules and they asked questions later, and I think that's one of the things, if you've got the confidence to break the rules. I mean, in a conservation sort of situation, you don't need conservation area consent actually to paint a building, therefore you don't need any consent to paint it with light as far as I can see, but you may need actually something actually to put the lights in the ground, but ask questions later, you know. And I think that a lot of things that we've done...
It's the Albert Speer approach.
I was going to say, that's typical conservation officer.
A lot of the things that you do, I think, are... it's easier to not do it than to do it, and you can look at all the reasons why you shouldn't do it, and if you focus on the reasons why you should do it or you want to do it, then I think you can often do it. But all these things are they can get in the way, but if you're going sort of through that, people often understand. Again, it's this openness about things, so people often understand. If you explain what you're trying to do, then I think on both sides people actually give and take a little bit. And I think most people do actually feel that the work that's actually done through Enhance the Environment in this way is a good thing. I don't think you have to persuade people about that. You just have to encourage people they can do it.
But presumably it can get blocked by a whole sort of committee process that lasts for potentially years.
If you take it to committee, it can. If you don't take it to committee, then... No, but seriously, I mean, I used to work a lot with conditions, because you can put a condition on a planning application that is dealt with afterwards, actually by officers and by an agreement. So these things don't go back to committee. You've got in the planning application, you've got a principle, there will be public art, and it might be like this, but there's a condition to say that you give the details on it. But those details don't go near a committee. And I think that can be a good thing, because at all scales of artwork or arts involvement, you don't need a committee. In fact, it's worse if it goes to a committee because people start to judge it for what it is rather than from the function it is.
How would you advise everybody to avoid the committee?
The answer's not in
there. No. It's about gaining people's confidence in the long run. It's about allowing people to... certainly there are ways in the planning field, actually, where you can write things into conditions, you can write them very loosely, and you can get that commitment. But at the end of the day, it's about the confidence and the relationships between the officers and the architects or the developer actually moving forward in that way. But most people I've found that most members want things to happen. They don't want things to stop happening. And if things are happening, then... and actually, these things aren't things that people... Well, I'm saying that. Silica. But...
Do you have any advice on breaking the rules, Jim? Or,
Well, we break them all the time. We just don't tell anyone.
I think part of it is educational, though. I think, you know, people are always afraid of the unknown, and sometimes it's a question of showing them examples, or sometimes it's maybe being a little bit economical with what you give them initially to get them on board. And there are different strategies, I think, for different situations, but I think primarily it is educational rather than... From where we come from, it's partly letting people know that you have the ability to do it, that you've done something similar before, that it is going to work, that there are, you know, good examples that you can show.
Okay,
it's very subversive, doesn't it?
Realm too far into the illegality situation. Is there another question that anybody wanted to pose to the? Yes, please. There, you wait.
Hi, my name is Catherine Brooks. I'm from Tewkesbury Councilman Urban. There, I was just wondering how you got around maintenance issues of the lighting, and who's maintaining it once it's in.
Well, one of the points you made was you're trying to make things low maintenance or no maintenance. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, you're using LED lights, so for a start, you shouldn't have to change a bulb for 20 years. Yeah. And the control mechanism is housed in a box that's above ground that's accessible, and you know, if it does need to be reprogrammed, then we have to do that. But everything else in the scheme is basically maintenance free. Okay, you're going to have to wash the aluminium scuppers once a year or something like that. I mean, we don't know exactly how often, because you know, it's quite a difficult environment. It's a very harsh environment. It's useful having a naval architect as part of your team, because at least you're specifying materials and you're specifying finishes, which cost a little bit more in at the beginning, but are designed to withstand the harsh conditions like here in Knightstone. But that's in a way almost an exceptional situation. If something survives in Knightstone, it'll survive anywhere, I think. It's probably.
I think the maintenance issue is a really good one, because it's one for those of you who work in local authorities, you know that maintenance, it's all that side of things, can rule the roost. And one of the things about maintenance is people often complain about maintenance, but one of the problems is people aren't maintaining things. But what they are doing, they're paying out actually for the cost of energy. And on our promenade sort of scheme, we've worked out that the energy costs are only 90% less than the existing energy consumption actually by upgrading. And because we're getting these phenomenal energy savings, it is helping us to get the maintenance issues over, because it's putting real sort of money back into those departments. And I think that it's a real opportunity to do that, certainly with lighting, because it sort of uses that energy. And as I say, that's a cost that is being shelled out, actually, whereas some of the maintenance issues, it's just talked about. But the real problem is things aren't being maintained.
Yes, please, yeah.
As George Wallace, Shelton Borough Council. Just going back to the previous point, when the ends do sometimes justify the means if the end is publicly well perceived. And so the question is, how has this artwork and this lighting work been perceived by the public in Weston? Are there any problems? How did you approach that with the media, in regard to the media?
Well, Silica was a very good example. It was very badly... on the face of it, it would be very badly perceived, actually, by local public opinion over the last probably 18 months. I think that one of the real reasons was that if you do this sort of work, especially the scale of Silica, you set yourself up as the major news story in that particular town or that particular settlement. So you're going to get, it's very easy to be dismissive of these things, and the local media tends to be. What that does, it gives people a legitimate standpoint because they're reading it in the paper that this is a bad thing. Interestingly, once the work is there, I think people make up their own minds, and we've got an election coming up, and I'm really happy that silica's not being used in the election as a major issue, whereas 6 months ago it probably would. But I think that talking to people on the ground, people are intelligent to make up their own minds about these things, and they do. And I think that if the processes are right and the funding is right and all the rest of it, you end up actually by doing this sort of process through competitions and actually getting experience, but people and giving them power to work, if you like, actually what they do best, I think you end up with a good result. And that invariably comes sort of through in contexts where often we don't do that. You know, it's half a job we'll do often. And I think that these things actually shine through at the end of the day. But you don't make any friends on the way. I think you've always got to be sort of prepared to. And I mean, we have some very good people working on that. Put art consultant Sir Leslie Green, Diana Hatton, and the artist of Wolfgang Buttress, and we worked very closely together. And as a small sort of core team, and it was hard at times, but you have to be prepared for that if you're going to do anything worthwhile, I think. We had help from the PR team within the council who were very positive as well. But I mean, we were working against a couple of local newspapers who knew they'd sell a lot of newspapers if it was on the front cover again and again, and they were calling it the carrot and all. And it was meant to be derogatory. I think I called it a term of endearment in one newspaper interview, and then they stopped using it, you know, because I said I liked the expression of carrot. I thought it was really nice that people called it the carrot. So you just think of ways of actually turning those arguments round. But yeah, it can be quite hard at times. You want to go home sometimes.
A lighting project's always criticised in the media, Oliver?
No, I don't think they are, actually. Generally speaking, they're relatively well received, because as we spoke about earlier, I think people can sort of understand light, can't they? And I would say probably silica is a slight different thing, and it isn't just about light, is it?
No,
it's a great big shape in the middle of town.
It was a big hole in the ground for a long time, so that with a light installation I think you can do it fairly quick, turn it on and then
yeah.
The impact is there. You're not going through this whole gestation of...
That's right. I mean, even though you were quite critical about the cinema piece, what was it called again? The Playhouse. I'm so sorry. You know, that presumably hasn't attracted any negative.
That's been very, very well received by the public. I think it's just me that thinks it's.
Yeah.
And we're very lucky with Knightstone Island because it's an island. I think if that was in the high street, goodness knows what we'd be doing at the moment. So you put the fences up at one end and no one ever looks. No one ever walks around it, so...
Yeah, but I think, you know, provided it's temporary, people can kind of get over it, can't they? I wouldn't imagine it to be terribly... I haven't, in my research, and in general, found much antipathy towards lighting schemes as such, or light art, really. I mean, anybody else?
Anybody found something that's particularly hostile?
Not something that's particularly come
local
up.
Local media or fears they're going to come across a particularly hostile local media.
It'd be interesting to know, you know, if there's anybody from the Glasgow experience, because obviously that was a budget issue, and it tends to be media hostility is often predicated around budget.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? As a way in to attack the idea.
Justin, what about you in London? What was the reaction there?
We got a good media reaction, but there was no real problem to it. It came on the back of a very bad media reaction to the lighting of the Buckingham Palace, though, because that happened probably about a month before, and it had a double-page spread. I think it was in the Mail.
Mm.
It was absolutely slated, and just criticised people to believe. So we just panicked, but we actually got a really good reaction. So.
Mm.
I think people like it.
Mm.
Yeah, they like their lit environment, they like to like each other, entertainment as well.
And the argument in Glasgow, if I remember, when I was in the press, was more about
the size of the budget, which was a pretty large budget, if I remember. I don't know exactly, but it was probably 10 times what most people here have a chance to work with.
Yeah, I mean, Glasgow does have enormous pockets, doesn't it, in that respect. I'm not surprised they're going for another round.
I was just going to say, having sort of, I was living in Glasgow at the time, just the effect on the streets at night, it was very much a carnival atmosphere, and you had people up with their kids to show their kids, and you know, people were discovering laneways that had never been down before, kind of little hidden bits of architecture they hadn't come across before. So it actually got people navigating the city in a very different way, and kind of, in a way, revealed elements of the city that they hadn't been aware of. And so, okay, there was some press about how much it cost, but actually, I think long term, it's been very positive.
I think also there was a very good relationship with lighting companies. Is it Igazzini or something?
Igazzini
in Glasgow, who helped pay for some of the lighting of some of the buildings, I think, as well there, which was some kind of contra deal they had as part of the lighting of the whole city. So the Mitchell Library, which is one of the centrepieces of Glasgow's architecture, is beautifully lit now. I think that was all paid for by Igazzini as part of the wider deal. So,
I mean, also, I think, I mean, I probably got a commission on the back of that for the redevelopment of the former Strathclyde Regional Council offices, which are being demolished at the moment. But the developer wanted to light the building before it was demolished, partly because it's highly visible and to get media attention, and kind of got the Lower Cross to come and turn on the lights and all of that. And so I think, you know, there are examples of where developers are beginning to think, oh, well, we can use lighting in a positive way, and we can use, I mean, basically they use it to get column inches. I got work out of it, so that's okay as well. So I think it just takes somebody to break the mould, and I think once that happens, then people see the value.
I think cost's a really interesting issue, because I don't think it matters what the cost is, it's just the point that it costs something, because I think there's a real lack of understanding within this country about how much things actually do cost, and even when you've got quite a reasonable budget and you're getting value for money out of it, but people still seem to complain that it's too much, and I think when you look at all the major projects, and the Olympics are good examples and things like that, you know, these costs are bandied around, and they don't really mean anything to anybody, you know, because you don't see any breakdown of what that cost is. They're just figures, and I think that we certainly have sort of felt that with sort of Silica, and we felt that we were getting everything at cost and extremely good value for money, and yet we were always being told it was too much. And then when I asked, well, how much do you think it should cost, actually certain journalists, they didn't know at all. And I asked people to price sort of travelling light, how much would that cost, and one of the journalists thought it would cost about £10,000 for the whole piece. And I said, the artists worked for 2 years on that piece.
They were overpaid then, as you
said. Yeah, would you do that? If the whole thing cost £10,000, what were they getting the cost to do it? And they don't seem to, or people don't seem to actually relate just what the value of actually, what they earn on a day-to-day basis with the value of actually things they're doing in the public realm. It seems very odd to me, to be honest.
I suppose there are lessons about how you build a case for a project and get media coverage and so on, that we could do with learning from each other. So if London got particularly good relationship, I think that's something to learn from, because what you can do without at that stage is a hostile media to a project. I think that and they're always going to focus on cost, and none of the, that's the only thing that they will focus on is the work.
That's right, except there might now be the environmental audit aspect as well, which is the next most contentious thing.
So should we pursue that a little bit? I mean, has anybody come across this as a problem in their own area of work in terms of environmental criticism and complaints? That's an easy life, don't they? Maggie, do you want to... wait for the microphone, please, Maggie.
Yes, you are. Because when there was a project a few years ago called Flow, did you came across that one? Well, Flow was about the improvement of the docks before the Gloucester Heritage was set up. And the artist practice, Muff, worked on it with the urban designers who were doing the framework and the master plan and so on. And quite a lot of the projects proposed involve light, some temporary ones to highlight changes and everything else. But what actually happened there was that Muff had come up with some very... I think when people selected out which was which, it was because, with kind of respect, some of the kind of suppliers' ones were a bit more kind of literal and a bit obvious, and the artist ones had a bit more of a quirk to them, which is what I think people were picking up on. And Muff had proposed some really nice projects, and the RDA was so enthused, they went off and got a lighting specialist to do the project itself, which of course lost the whole essence of what it was. And that was quite a difficult one to try and explain to them, that although they were being enthusiastic and saying, yeah, we'll go ahead and do it, and they paid twice as much for it because they went to the lighting specialist, it lost the essence of what it could have been, which was that element of subtlety. And I think the other thing that people sometimes worry about is the vandalism aspect. And certainly the traditional flood lighting of cathedrals or whatever cathedral been, and the lights getting kicked in and everything else, when technology's moved on. But I wonder if anyone had any comments about that, because again, in Gloucester, the light piece in the docks, when I last saw it, there were obviously problems there, whether they were technical or whatever. But I think that might be sometimes when people don't maybe have access to technology or understand what they can do. Vandalism can be an issue because they've got really exposed work. So I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that.
Has anybody got a comment on that? Yes, please.
Thank you.
Ian Williams of Gloucester Heritage URC. Well, I don't know that I've got a specific comment on the flood example, but I can bring you some experience from a couple of pieces that I've been involved in, tangentially at least. In Coventry, where I worked previously as an urban designer, they had the Phoenix project, the Millennium project, which delivered a large new public square, which had the time zone clock in lighting in the floor. And the concept, I forget the artist, forgive me, but I thought Joachim Goetz was the bench. Yeah. But anyway, the time clock concept was an interesting one, that you would buy a disc to put it, get installed on the ground next to your time zone, and you'd use a console to sort of select your time zone, and it would light up, and it would be lit at night and whatever. Anyway, the concept was good, but then the usual sort of cost engineering came in, and rather than having this series of neon tubes let into the ground so that it was flush with the ground, it was delivered in a sort of raised bumper, which gave you a sort of couple of inches high sort of series of lines across this public square. And the reason for doing that was ostensibly, well, you know, we can't afford to do it properly, we'll do this and that'll be fine. But then the thing to remember then is, what's the life cost of this project? What happened was that they found they couldn't use the public space afterwards without decking it over every time they wanted to use it. And so that cost wasn't taken into account. And the other thing that they had to do subsequently as well was, there's a very strong universal access lobby in Coventry. And so they had to let in a whole series of brass studs around this as a hazard, sort of warning of a hazard for people with impaired sight. So whereas they thought they were saving money at the time, and whether or not they might have not been able to deliver it is a question, I suppose, but you know, in the long term, not doing a proper job cost them a lot more than doing it properly. So that's one example that might be interesting in terms of lighting. And the other example that Maggie was mentioning was there's an artist called Andrew Stonier who did, I think it's called an Infinity light piece, which was a series of light boxes, again let in this time flush to the ground in Gloucester, in a public square beside a small chapel. And they would, I hadn't seen it in action unfortunately, but they would in theory light up on a time sort of series basis, along with neon tubes running under some concrete benches. Very effective. But the problem with that was, in commissioning rather than in the concept, again, the concept Andrew Stonewall's, but the commissioning authority was the Regional Development Agency. They chose, rather than to use Andrew Stonewall and his team to put it out to a sort of another company who went bust, produced something that leaked and then didn't work. And of course, the perennial problem with writing is it was under the ground, as you were mentioning. It's a devil to put right afterwards. So there's some sort of practical issues to do. So horribly tedious in terms of the creative thinking, but these practicalities can make or break a scheme. And I think that Infinity Lightboxes has been about a year in putting right, and all sorts of legal wrangling to decide who to sue. There are these things in mind.
Yes. Any comments on those practical issues? Or has your work ever been vandalised, Jim? Apart from by fish in the end, haven't
you? Not that I can think of. I mean, I think there's always a maintenance issue, and if somebody doesn't change the bulb or something, if you're using fiber optics and somebody doesn't change the bulb every 2 years or whatever, then you're going to have a problem. I think with something like the piece we're doing at Lightstone Island, we've had to sort of, in a way, over-engineer that because we're basically dealing with waves that are going to be coming in over the wall and draining out through the actual work over the lighting. So that has to be absolutely tried and tested. And so, in a way, you have to probably spend a little bit extra initially, which is probably what you were talking about. If they had done it properly in the first instance, they wouldn't have issues now, and I think you just have to do that. But I think also you can, you know, make sure that if you are using a supplier, that things come with whatever, a 2-year guarantee or a 5-year guarantee, and that you absolutely hold them to it as well, you know.
Okay, yes, there's a question there.
Hi, it's Hayley Stokes, Devon County Council. It was a question to Mark, actually, because I had a little wander around at lunchtime and saw the silica art piece. I just wanted to know, it was quite interesting to see that you had like a little kiosk and a bus stop incorporated into the base of it. Was that planned from the start, or was it something that developed later on? Or I'm just quite interested to know, because I've never seen that before then.
We wanted, So when we wrote the brief, there were a series of aspirations for that particular space, and to have a kiosk, which was part of the wayfinding concept, the bus stop was part of the movement concept, and it was a popular place. And we just wanted to add everything into the brief for that particular work that was in that space. There was lighting, wayfinding, everything. We just put it all in the brief. We weren't expecting anyone to come out with everything. And of the piece that won the competition actually did do that. One of the advantages of having the kiosk in the structure is that we have an income of about £10,000 a year, which goes into the maintenance of the structure, and it covers all the energy costs and everything. So it's self financing in a way in terms of the maintenance. The bus stop is interesting because I think that we've had lots of conversations very late at night with a number of drunk people in the bus stop, and you're putting together sort of two ends of the spectrum, really. And it really is actually people's art when you stick a bus stop, which goes to some of the estates that it does do. And it's been one of the nice aspects of the project, because it used to be called Gossip's Corner, apparently. Diana Hatton told me that. It used to be called Gossip's Corner, and you can stand in the kiosk and you hear everything that's being said in the bus shelter. And it's quite amazing who talks to who in that sort of bus shelter. And a lot of people have a go at it, but in a nice way. It's actually quite odd. It's a real conversation piece, and I think that it's provided lots of challenges. I mean, it's been used for all the antisocial things that bus stops are, and some people have enjoyed doing that because of what it is, I think. But at the same time, you know, I really think it's one of the things in public art that Jim talked about, you know, having that sort of crossover, having that functionality to it, which I think is that where we're going, I think, actually, with art in the environment. The things that that don't have a dual function are far less sort of viable in today's sort of context. I mean, we live in a world of, sort of liability and costs and all those other things. I just think Well, some people have said to me, why is it so tall? Is it so the bus drivers know where it is? I had one person say to me, which is quite interesting. Do you get a lot of strange questions?
Okay, we should just address this environmental issue, I think, because it is becoming potentially a key issue now. I mean, Jim, you were saying about how the costs of some, what comment did you, Mark, or Jim, about the minimal cost of some of the projects in terms of electricity use and so on. I mean, the perception outside is these things are very costly and that they're wasteful as well. And I think that, you know, as climate change reporting becomes more and more important, this is perhaps it's a battle we need to win now rather than wait until we do it in defence. But how would you go about that? I mean, you're a journalist, so you're
story. It's an interesting and vexing one. I mean, notice actually that the London Festival had it right up front, as if to, not exactly forestall criticism, but to meet it head on. I think I would argue it would be an important thing to do for any light project that had any scale at all, because it's a very visible medium. People are going to notice it, and it is going to attract this kind of attention. I mean, as this very event did, you see. So, I think I would make sure from the get-go that it was kind of audited as closely as possible so that you could marshal the arguments for it in an intelligent way that argued its benefits and kind of mitigated its environmental costs. Clearly, using LED and these sorts of things, I don't know, negligible, is it fair to use that word?
We're confident we're going to be generating more electricity with the windmills anyway than we're using, so we'll actually be feeding back into the national grid.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether the council actually gain anything from that, but at least it doesn't.
Yeah, we don't really gain anything because the way it's actually financed, but I think things are.
I mean, did you include that, as it were, for public relations' sake?
No, I mean, we definitely wanted to sort of effectively reduce the carbon footprint.
Right.
And we also wanted to make the gateway feature in a way much more functional than just being something that people pass through, because it actually, in a way, it reminds them, yes, this is wind power, and it reminds every visitor to Weston that there's wind power being used here, and they might think about it and kind of take it back to where they operate. Or it's just kind of, it's a little environmental reminder, really, which is kind of a little, it's fairly upfront, but at the same time, the idea is that it will kind of be in people's memories for a long, long time afterwards. Yeah. And somebody else might say, we could use windmills as our gateway feature rather than something else.
I think it's a great idea. I just wondered what the origination of it was. I mean, another thing that comes up is the sort of, which might seem like deflection to some people, the sort of, the Mike O'Leary and Ryanair approaches, whenever anybody sort of like criticises aviation as being wasteful, he says, well, hang on a minute, most carbon emissions are, from housing. So you're suggesting we don't live in houses. It's quite a sort of counter-aggressive, if you know what I mean. Now, obviously, with lighting schemes of the sort that we've been talking about, by far and away the biggest kind of like waste of lighting is amenity lighting, office lighting that's left on all night, unnecessary street lighting and motorway lighting. I mean, in a way, at one point, we need to be able to sort of say, we're trying to do something here that is enhancing the environment at very little cost, and there are a lot of places out there that are doing exactly the opposite. In central London where I live, the offices burn brightly pretty well all night. Whether they aim to have kind of, movement activated lighting, somehow it's on all night. I don't know who's moving up there. you know, and these, in a sense, I have to say, are the bigger culprits. But unfortunately, because lighting festivals and their ilk are demonstrative, you know, they will attract a certain amount of criticism. My point is that we have to be prepared to answer that in an intelligent way. Don't you think?
I'd agree, totally, yes, but up front, if possible, to make sure there's a case made right from the start, I think. Is this something that the website could do, for example, case studies on costs of...
Well, I was going to say, we have got quite a lot of case studies on our website, which you've got in the pack, from kind of Team Bridge in Devon to Turin Light Festival. In history, and the paper that we've commissioned from Oliver will be on the site with the reference to the books and images and things. And Oliver made a slight reference to the fact that when this was advertised, I had quite a lot of correspondence with various people about light pollution and effects. And I think there is a danger, I think temporary projects and projects which actually help reduce overall bad lighting are to be encouraged, actually. And one of the dangers is that the ideas get taken, and as Ian was saying, people like the idea because of their procurement policy, which is highly problematic, to point out to them, but then goes into the hands of someone else and gets bastardized as an idea. And I think that anyone who's working in those ways, you know, to make the case, especially when you find you're in that situation where the artist's original ideas, then you say, well, we'll go out to tend to get someone else to deliver. And so, well, actually, no, because that is the artist's creative concept. And certainly, if you're running across issues like that, we're very happy to help and assist in that. And we could certainly do some more work around there if we found it's proven to be a problem for people. But at the moment, it doesn't really seem to be. But okay. We can certainly keep an eye on that. Mm. Yes.
Okay. Does anybody have a final question for the panel before I invite Maggie to... Yes, please, yeah.
Ian Williams again, so I'm hogging this rather. You're talking about the ephemerality, if that's the right phrase, of lighting projects. And there's got to be a range of projects in that. You have festival events and you have projects which are more semi-permanent. What I'm interested in hearing from the panel is, looking at the sort of semi-permanent installations, What is the lifespan of these projects? Because I think that's one of the key questions. If you're a member of the public, you expect something to last forever. And lighting changes quite rapidly with technology. I don't know, are we talking 5 years or 20 years or what?
Want to start?
Well, certainly, if we start with the piece we're doing for Nightstone, we would expect a minimum of 20 years on that. But then... that's so embedded into the structure of, structure of the seawall, effectively, unless the seawall gets blown away in the 1 in 100 year waves, that's going to stay there and it's not going to dramatically change. I suppose if you expanding it more in terms of semi-permanent or temporary work, I think it can be one. It can be one evening. It can be one week. It can be one month. It depends on who your audience is and sort of what point you're trying to make.